excited to be here today as we celebrate the public opening of Henry Ford Museum's Rock Stars, Cars, and Guitars exhibit. This exhibit, created by the Henry Ford, connects two of America's greatest loves, cars and music, in an electric display of amazing rides and iconic guitars owned by the most legendary artists in the music business today, including Bob Seger, Kid Rock, John Lennon, Elvis, Chuck Berry, Bo Diddley, Madonna, Rick Nielsen, and Elton John. And I can't think of a better way to officially open this exhibit than to have one of those legends speak before us today. Before we begin, I would like to encourage everyone to take some time today and visit Rockstars, Cars, and Guitars. At the end of our program, you can purchase tickets to the museum at any of our ticket locations. The exhibition is free with the cost of admission. And now I'd like to introduce our moderator for this afternoon, Gary Graff. Gary is an award-winning journalist who's been covering music from the Detroit area since 1982. His work appears locally in the Oakland Press and other Journal Register Company properties, and he is WCSX-FM's Classic Rock Insider. He also contributes regularly to UPI, Billboard, the Cleveland Plain Dealer, the New York Times Feature Syndicate, and a variety of magazines. Gary is also the founding editor of the award-winning Music Hound Essential Album Guide series and also compiled the 2005 book, Bruce Springsteen, A to E to Z. He is also co-founder and co-producer of the Detroit Music Awards. Please join me in welcoming Mr. Gary Graff.
Okay, thank you, John. Your check's in the mail for that. How's everybody doing today? Okay, Saturday morning can be a little challenging for a rock and roll audience, but I hope everybody's awake, ready to have a good time this morning. How many of you have been able to get through the exhibit so far? I know it's really early. Make sure you do. Really, congratulations are in order for the Henry Ford Museum, for the people here who curated it and put it together. It's a wonderful exhibit. One can only think of what went on in the back of that Marilyn Manson car they have, or the Madonna limousine, but go see it. Let your imaginations run wild. And make sure you don't miss the guitar portions either, because there's some really freaky kind of guitar stuff there. It's interesting today to be having a lecture that combines cars and guitars, meaning the auto industry and the music industry, and to be doing it here in a museum. Because we are talking about industries that we all know are in great change right now, and dare I say, the way they're structured now, they're becoming museum pieces in a way. The auto industry, if we're from Detroit, we all know what that's about. The music industry changes at lightning speed. It changes at the speed, really, of a laser anymore, or at a gigabyte. And the way we consume music right now and the way music's being made right now is so different than it was from the way when some of those guitars that are in the exhibit are played that it's striking and alarming. It makes some of us curious, if not fearful, for the future of music. And that's part of what we're going to be talking about this morning. And I can't think of having anybody better to talk about it here than Don was. Don started music from playing music and singing, performing, recording, since really, I think, before he was doing Sir Douglas Quintet songs at Oak Park High, along with his Was brother, David Was. The two of them created the quintessential Detroit collective in Was Not Was, the kind of band that put together this stew of rock, funk, pop, soul, jazz, everything about it that if anybody ever had to say what is a Detroit record, you'd hand them a Was Not Was album, because it had a little bit of everything on it, including Detroit people like Mitch Ryder and Doug Feiger, and probably the only records in the world where Ozzy Osbourne and Mel Torme and Frank Sinatra Jr. could all be on the same record. That's a particular Detroit kind of thing to do, and it's something we've been immensely proud of, that's a band, you know, or a collective that David and Don brought from the city. Now, Don has, like David, has gone on and expanded his reach in music. When you just look at the guy's resume and what he's done in the production world, the Rolling Stones, Bonnie Raitt, Bob Dylan, Bob Seger, Garth Brooks, Willie Nelson, You can ask Don about things he did with Willie Nelson. Elton John, Brian Wilson, the Bare Naked Ladies. Don't ask him about things he did with the Bare Naked Ladies. The B-52s, and this is just a few from a very, very long list of artists that Don has worked with. He's won 2 Grammy Awards, including Producer of the Year in 1995. He's been involved with records that have sold more than 80 million copies worldwide, so at the end of this, you can ask him for a loan. Now, you might have noticed there's a piano on stage. The good news is it's not for me. And so it's my pleasure now to introduce you to the man who is going to be using that piano off and on during our talk. Let's pretend it's Saturday night and not Saturday morning, and please welcome Don Was.
Wow. I'm so pleased here. I kind of thought I'd be talking to my cousin Edie and Garzelle McDonald. Thank you very much for coming out this early. Already, it feels a little awkward to just break into a song. It feels like my first piano recital or something like that. I'll talk for a minute. It's an honor to be here. It's a great exhibit, and This is really cool to be at the Henry Ford Museum. I used to come here with my grandpa as a young boy. And how great is this? Very cool. And Gary, thank you very much for coming out today. I don't know if y'all know, Gary Graff is really one of the most respected music writers in the world. I know when the Rolling Stones put out a new album, they always, he's like one of 5 guys that they insist on talking to. Known him for 25 years, and we're very lucky to have a guy like this in Detroit. So, it's feeling a little friendlier now. I was going to play just a few songs throughout the day that have some relevance to what we'll be talking about. This one is from a Was album called What Up Dog. And it's a great lyric. It's written by David Was, who I believe is running around this building somewhere. David wrote the lyric, I wrote the music. And it's a great lyric. David, but Bob Dylan told me once, he said, you know, David Was is one of the greatest living American poets. I said, yes, that's true, he is. And this song is about it's about the future, about how the future we were promised in the 50s and 60s really didn't quite materialize. A future did materialize. It's not a bad one, but it's sure different from what we thought was coming. It's called Somewhere in America. There's a street named after my dad and the home we never had. Night, only crickets, no prowlers, no sirens, no pinky ring hustlers, no angel dust Byrons, no bars on the windows, no saber-toothed neighbors, just good, simple folks in a rainbow of flavors, somewhere in America, there's a street named after my dad and the home we never had. I'm gonna work for Mr. Fowler. I'm gonna make 50 cents an hour, and I'll save what I can so I can get a piece of land. I'll raise some cows and carrots. I'll get ahead on my own merits, and if I fall, I'll take it like a man. Somewhere in America, There's a street named after my dad, and the home we never had. No more bland TV dinners, no more 10-car collisions, no showbiz beginners making global decisions. Fred Thompson. No daycare Fellinis, no fast food assassins, no billboard bikinis, just some truth and compassion. Somewhere in America, there's a street named after my dad, and a home we never had. Thank you.
So Sweet Pea's out of a job now, huh?
I've never done that. I don't even do that, like sing those songs for my kids. I mean, I've always played these things on bass.
Yeah, something about singing David White songs to your kids that would be a little sketchy anyway, I think. All right, it's interesting what you said in introducing that song, because the idea of it, and I'd always heard that in there too, the idea of kind of an accidental future or an unplanned future. And it seems to me that's kind of the way the music business has been this... Not always an accident, but not always what was intended to happen as it went along.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, I think if you really go back through the history of it, like if you take Edison, for example. Thomas Edison actually made the first record. He recorded himself reciting Mary Had a Little Lamb, and he did it right in this building that's a couple hundred yards away from us, this Menlo Park Laboratory. And he was so pleased, with the invention. He published a list of all the things it could be used for. It could be used for dictation. It could be used for clocks that would announce the time, for recording books, for the blind. But he didn't really see the value in recording live musical performances. But other companies did. There's the Deutsche Grammophon Company started. A rival firm that started Columbia Records, and they were selling their version of the phonograph with their own cylinders, and they signed a bunch of artists. The Victor Company had the Victrola Company, and between the two of them, they signed Enrico Caruso, they signed John Philip Sousa, and they cornered the market on all the popular mainstream artists. So when Edison was a little late to the gig and realized that there was something valuable here, the only thing left, really by default, he went out and recorded indigenous American music. He went down to New Orleans, recorded jazz. He recorded blues. He recorded Appalachian fiddlers. And he really created the first collection of great American music, but not because he was a fan. It was just that was all that was left. And the odd twist of events that no one could have foreseen was that it became really popular. So the bigger companies moved in. They tried to squelch his records as much as they could, and they came up with their own version of this. They came up with a kind of white jazz. That's actually what it was called. So you went from Louis Armstrong to a guy like Paul Whiteman, or from Charlie Patton to Al Jolson, say, And they were helped along by religious zealots, who branded the jazz music as being, leading to drugs and prostitution and all that. So you can almost see a pattern that emerges there of a technological advance. And because of the everyone being caught off guard, something new inadvertently slips through the cracks that becomes very popular artistically and then gradually becomes co-opted and watered down, by corporate interests. It happens today, Taylor Hicks doing a Marvin Gaye song is a good example of that. Why have it?
Is that co-opting something that can be good for the art, though, in the way that it, it helps define the alternative? It creates a landscape from which a new alternative can emerge.
Well, yeah, Bob Dylan's a good example of that. Bob Dylan's a guy who
borrowed from Southern blues and Chicago blues, and he borrowed from, you know, the populism of like Woody Guthrie, and he borrowed from the beat poets, and he came up with something new that was all his own. But that's how everybody does stuff. But that's good co-opting, right?
Right. Well, and that's the thing. It seems like it just creates an environment for something else to spring from, because there's always something to rebel against, or you hope there are people who will rebel against the status quo.
Well, yeah, I think change is essential. Yeah.
Sure. Who are you now? What are you hearing in terms of directions of new and, you know, and that alternative now?
Well, there's cool stuff happening. You know, I mean, overall, I think we may be at the bottom end of the co-opting cycle. But there's a lot of good stuff out there. I just heard this band, the Old Crow Medicine Show. Right. You know them?
Yeah.
And they take bluegrass music, but there's something decidedly not, you know, they're not from Kentucky. I don't think they are anyway. Either. Yeah. But it's got a real rock and roll sensibility to it. It's a very cool thing. So, you know, I mean, that'd be good co-opting. I mean, Dylan still does good co-opting. I don't know what music exactly. It's almost like he's tapped into that kind of white jazz stuff, but turned it back into something else.
How did you meet him? What's your Bob Dylan story?
Did I actually meet him? Okay, well, has anybody seen the movie The Freshman with Marlon Brando and Matthew Broderick? You familiar with that? Well, David and I were hired to score this movie. And one of the perks of one of the perks of having of the job was that we got to be in the movie. We played Burt Parks' backup band. You remember Burt Parks? He hosted the Miss America contest. And so he played himself appearing at this banquet in which Marlon Brando was serving the last of an endangered species of Komodo dragons. Right. So we're in the scene. We had to pre-record the music with him. We recorded Burt Parks singing, "Here he comes, your Komodo dragon." And then we did a version of Tequila and Maggie's Farm. And the week that we were in Toronto filming the scene, Bob Dylan was appearing there. Okay, so we called a mutual acquaintance who arranged for us to go over and meet him and see the show. So David and I, we got very nervous. How do you just, you don't just show up at the hero's doorstep there empty-handed. So we went to a video store, and I guess by renting with intention to never return, I guess we stole a copy of Garden of the Fitzy Continis, and we got him some microwave popcorn for the bus. Now, David's mother used to say that, she said, "Boys, you always have to take things one step too far," or something. So we also threw in the song that we wanted him to record it was a shameless hustle. We turned a lovely gesture into a shameless hustle, basically. And we brought him a song that we had written that we wanted him to sing for maybe Less Than Zero or, you know, one of those movies. And he was very gracious. We had a nice time with him. And he said he'd listen to the song. And he called back a few weeks later, and he said, "Well, you know, I don't really do other people's material. But I got this song left over from Oh Mercy. You can produce that." So, again, a good example of things happening not the way you intended them. And so David and I ended up producing Under the Red Sky with Bob Dylan. And he didn't do the song, but we recorded the song a couple years later for Was Not Was album called Are You Okay? And we actually had a hit. It was like a top 10 sing. So again, not what we intended. I could play that song for you.
I was going to say, why don't you play that song?
This is one of those lyrics that David said. Everyone wondered, is this one about me? She ran him over like a bus, but he didn't seem to feel no pain. Just laid there smiling like a flower in the rain. She shrunk his ego down so small he didn't even know his name.
She knew no other way to love. That's just how she played the game. But when he got her in a darkened room in the still of the afternoon, he became her entire world, and she cried like a little girl. I was a line between pleasure and pain, can't be measured by means of the brain. Mere reason alone will never explain how the heart behaves. She wrapped her claws around him like a crab around a rock. It was always baby this and baby that, man, she never let him talk. He couldn't see his shadow, cause she was always in his light. And if he moved, she arched her back and dug them claws in tight. But when he got her in a darkened room in the still of the afternoon, she became his entire world, and he cried like a little girl. Cause the line between pleasure and pain can't be measured by means of the brain. Mere reason alone, you can hear where it's like Dylan, will never explain how the, that's what we had in mind. He didn't go for it. And they said that he'd break. How much more could it take? And just when you thought that he'd kill her, she'd give him a kiss, and it never missed. But then one day she ran away with a guy she hardly knew. She left a note that said, I'm bored with me and you. So he got another girl for himself. She was a high-heeled hurricane. There was no calm inside of her eyes, just a promise of more the same. Cause the line between pleasure and pain can't be measured by means of the brain. Mere reason alone will never explain how the heart behaves.
Dylan's still kicking himself for not taking that.
Well, he was a sucker.
Yeah, it's so back to our regularly scheduled program.
Yes,
with this.
Good.
When we were talking about, you know, kind of that path that the industry's taken and the music business has taken, a parallel course kind of has been radio and what's happened with that. Because that is, you know, still, even though it didn't necessarily start as a music medium, its fortunes really have been inextricably tied to music.
That's absolutely true. It started it started by GE wanted to sell table radios, so they came up with this idea. They were $75 each. Radio had been used for military purposes in the First World War. And the first big radio show was a guy named Frank Conrad. Have you heard this guy? He announced the time every 30 seconds. And people went crazy for it. You know, they had the correct time allowed in their home. The problem was you couldn't tune in the station in between. You never knew if you were in the right frequency. So this guy had the idea to go to a local record store, borrow some records in exchange for a mention of the shop, and he played music in between pronouncements of the time. And that was the advent of commercial radio right there. And it worked great because GE was trying to sell these radios to the mainstream white America, right? And because they were using the federal airwaves, the FCC got involved and further regulated the Edisonian traits of the previous era. And so nothing sexually suggestive, politically subversive, or religiously blasphemous, actually, you know, could be used, the radio. So that kept it very white. It was great for Paul Whiteman and Bing Crosby and Al Jolson. Unfortunately, ASCAP came out. Do you know what ASCAP is? It's the American Society of Composers, Authors, and Publishers. And there's an elite guild. They still exist. I'm a member today. It's a cool organization today, but it comes from really sinister origins. It was the Gershwin's those devils, Alan J. Lerner and people like that, and they wouldn't let blues artists in, they wouldn't let country artists in. It was just the elite group. And they wanted to get paid for the songs being played on the radio. And the radio stations thought they were out of their minds, you know. So they said, well, we just won't play your songs, we'll play other songs. And they formed something called the Broadcast Music Group, which is BMI, Broadcast Music Incorporated. They had to do the same thing Edison did. They went out and they signed indigenous music that was considered non-commercial. They signed all the blues artists and all the country artists and the Appalachian artists and the gospel artists. And so radio started playing the BMI songs because they were free. And again, that caught on with people. And eventually ASCAP had to capitulate and just with pressures to, again, to sell radios to the white mainstream. It got cleaned up for Frank Sinatra.
Can we do a quick primer, just because we have brought up the whole publishing scheme? How does somebody who writes a song actually get money for that song they wrote? Because that's tied in with this with these publishing companies.
Well, there's several ways you get. I mean, it started out with sheet music. You know, that was Stephen Foster sold sheet music and was actually, you know, he made like $200 for Oh Susanna, and that was a big
that's
deal.
Good money, yeah.
Yeah. But then, of course, with the other technologies that came along, you get every time a record is sold, I think songwriters get maybe 6 cents per song or something like that, which can add up if you get a song on Thriller. And then every time it's played on the radio, a songwriter gets paid. The artists don't get paid. The record companies don't get paid. Producers don't get paid. But the songwriters get paid. And just anywhere you hear music, ASCAP or BMI is there to collect it. If you go into a bar that has a jukebox, that bar is paying $60 a month or something to the writers. How they divide it up remains one of the great mysteries of the music business. We know these organizations collect it, and I know we get checks and everything, but they have some mysterious formula that no one is never revealed. You never know what it is. Sure.
And people, you also get, there's also a performing royalty that gets paid as well that doesn't have to do with ASCAP and BMI, right? Or does it?
Well, the mechanical royalty is what it's called, which is what you get from the records. That doesn't come from ASCAP. That goes right to the publishers. But performance royalties means the song being performed on radio or anywhere where music is featured. If they're playing Muzak out in the hallway here, if Mantovani wrote the song, I don't know. The artists don't get it, but the songwriters get paid for that.
Sure. Now, when we were talking about radio and its role, then the big revolution that happened, too, was radios in cars, so that you could hear rock stars' guitars on cars' radios.
That's very good. I hadn't even thought about that technological innovation. Does anyone know when they started putting... is Tom Grill? Is that... There you are. Tom will know. Tom is the epitome of this exhibit here because he's a bigwig at Lincoln Mercury. We've done some cool work on commercials, and he's also a great guitar player. And your guitar should be in his collection. But do you know when did they start putting in the 40s? Well, maybe it was. I don't know. I was actually. I do drive Tom. I drive a Lincoln. Tom helped me get the truck. That's a whole other story. Thank you, Tom.
Now you and Marshall Crenshaw have a good Lincoln story.
Do you know that story? That's on his website.
It's a story that should be told.
I had a Lincoln Grand Marquis. Or a Mercury Grand Marquis, right? Okay, and it got stolen outside a Sound Suite recording studio on McNichols and Greenfield one day when I was making a record. And so I bought... Lincolns are good cars. I'm not knocking the Lincoln. I happened to buy a terrible jalopy, right? And I was producing Marshall Crenshaw on New Year's Eve in 1980, going into 1984. And that was a very big gig for me. He was the first American... recording artist who hired me to produce a record. So I picked him up at the Northland Inn, and I was very proud of this Lincoln. This is in 84. This is probably a 65, 64 Lincoln. And we drove to the studio, and it was a bad night overall. The Sound Suite was a great studio. A lot of records were made there, but it was not well known for maintaining the equipment properly. And the machine would not go out of record that night, and he was just fixing one. We lost his vocal anyway, and we ushered in the new year with Marshall hurling his guitar into the rock walls, the sound suite. And we left. I thought, as a producer, well, let me just cool things down here. It's New Year's. I suggested we go up to Amy Joy Donuts on 8 Mile in Greenfield and chill out after losing this vocal. He had a right to be mad. We got in this car, which I'd just gotten, and the blizzard had started, and the windshield wipers didn't work. So I drove all the way there with my head out the window, and he was livid by the time we got to the donut place, and he finally chilled out. I told him the story how David and I, we used to go to Amy Joy Donuts in high school for New Year's and shake hands. We were playing the role of losers. But, of course, in playing that role over and over, you become the... So Marshall didn't appreciate that. It was a disastrous night. We got back in the car, and the transmission froze. And I had to drive him back to Northland Inn in reverse down Greenfield. And he got out of the car with his guitar, and I never saw him again. I saw him a couple years ago when he played with the... he was playing with
the
MC5
thing, yeah.
But that was it. He went back to New York and hired T-Bone Burnett to finish the mix.
I don't know if it'd be a country song, but was there ever a song in that story?
Oh, yeah, there is a song. We had one car song. We had a song called Elvis's Rolls Royce.
You should play it.
Play it. There's no way I can get you to play harp on this, right? David Was is up here. I see him sitting up in the balcony. Great.
I can't tell. Are all those fingers extended, or was it
just the
one?
Oh, yeah, I see movement. Okay, here he comes. All right, good. Good, okay. Can you play? Just jump. It's okay. Do the John Wilkes Booth down here. Do you have a harp?
Yes.
What key in?
We've got an E here. Look on the side of the box, David.
F. So if you're playing blues, cross harp is what? Well, I saw a crowd gathered. Must have been somebody shot. Reporters scribbled shorthand, and they photographed the spot. I looked in a little closer, but I could not see no blood. Just a gold-plated chariot arising from the mud. And I heard a soulful murmur, and it sounded like a voice. It began to sing. It was the king. This was Elvis's Rolls Royce. Where the wood grain bar was open, like he was about to have a drink. There was a white glove chauffeur at the wheel. Never saw him blink. The bobbies, they looked indifferent. Clearly they were not amused. This was just another auction piece, and it really didn't matter whose. Well, D-Day was upon me, and I had to make a choice. Next thing I know, I'm at the wheel of Elvis's Rolls Royce. Take it, David. Thank you. York City. David was. The crowds went wild, to say the least, as I pulled my precious cargo through the belly of the beast. And we turned left on the interstate, and we drove throughout the night till we reached the state of Tennessee in the early morning light. There they were, the gates of Graceland, and my eyes got kind of moist. It was the home sweet home to rock and roll and to Elvis's Rolls Royce.
David was.
He wrote that song. We were playing a gig in London, and David was walking around, and he walked past, I guess, the Sotheby's, and they were auctioning off Elvis's Rolls Royce. And he found it just outrageous that in this place where Elvis never even played, with all these sullen people standing around, that car should either be here at this exhibit or in Graceland. But hijacking the car. Thanks, Dave.
I think there's going to be a recitation of "Dad, I'm in Jail" up in the balcony after we get done with this today. Since we just had kind of a reunion here, there is going to be a "Was Not Was" album, right?
Yeah, we finished it last Friday, as a matter of fact. Yeah, we've been working on it. I've got a 14-year-old boy, my middle son Henry, and I said, you know, we started this before you were born, this album.
There you go.
But it's, I guess it's actually going to come out now. We're going to play some shows probably beginning of next year.
Cool, yeah. Cool. Now, as you start to think about bringing an album out and how that's going to be disseminated to the public, how do you view the music landscape now? It seems to me we're back in a jukebox kind of world.
The jukebox, that makes a lot of sense. It is like the jukebox because you really pick and choose individual songs. The jukebox was mob controlled, right? And they didn't care who they played. They didn't care if you were from BMI or ASCAP or San Quentin, you know, as long as there were quarters in the machine, or else at the end of the week, right? It was, and what the jukebox provided was a great equalizer. Because, as it turns out, Howlin' Wolf and Elvis and those guys were as popular as, you know, Tony Bennett and the McGuire sisters, if not more popular, and Hank Williams was popular. So suddenly you had these small record labels putting out this music because the major labels wouldn't. You had BMI publishing these, or collecting the publishing for these songs because ASCAP wouldn't touch it. And it became really popular. And, you know, these famous Senate hearings, the Payola scandals from the 50s, that really kind of changed the landscape of rock and roll one more time. And that really wasn't about the legal system. That was really Washington lobbyists hired by the major labels and by ASCAP to even the playing field here. Because if you could just slip a disc jockey $100, you'd get Muddy Waters played just as easily as you could Frank Sinatra, right? So It eventually worked. It took a while, but by the 60s, the major labels had most of the rock and roll, and ASCAP and BMI, you know, shared the thing, and that actually continued right up to the present time, where I think you've got this kind of American idolization of the music business that ultimately is going to hurt. I know people like it. My kids like the show and everything, but it's not. I don't think it's music that's going to be around that you'll want to hear repeatedly. What it has done, I think that the overall crisis in the music business has brought, it's forced kind of a confrontation here. The biggest problem I think that faces the record business is that everyone got greedy, you know, myself included. You know, everyone wants a piece of these things. The price shot up to $18.98. It used to be $4.98 when I was a kid. And records didn't get any better. Someone got the idea that because you could get 72 minutes of music on a CD, that was worth paying $18.98 for. But you basically get a couple of good songs, and you get more crap for $18.98.
And people just got tired of paying for it. So the jukebox is a great analogy because I think iTunes, in a way, is...
It's the jukebox.
It is a jukebox, yeah. And the system will have to change. Probably, if you want to change it for the better, start downloading music for free and bring the record companies to their knees.
We've been doing that, and the change is still so very slow. How do you, as an artist, does it change the creativity and the artistry at all? I mean, your Was Not Was is an album group, the Rolling Stones. You work largely with album artists. Yeah. But you're in a world now where people are buying songs, maybe a couple songs. Does it just drive you nuts? Or?
The objective, if you're going to make an album, make every song worthwhile. That's a big statement. It's really hard to do. It's hard to get people to edit them. One of the things that I think musicians had going for them was that when there was a vinyl album, you couldn't get more than 20 minutes on a side.
Right.
And so you know, in fact, I go through this with the Rolling Stones a lot. It's a running argument every record because I keep saying, well, you know, Beggar's Banquet is 36 minutes or whatever, you know, and you considered what you were doing with every 8 bars of music that was in there. If there's something that's just in there because it's there and it feels good or you like what you played, but it's not really contributing to the advancement of the record, you gotta have the courage to edit it out. And you had all these great 3.5 minute songs, and now people just ramble and it's self-indulgent. So I think that having some outside limits is a really good thing for music, you know? And if you know that if you make a filler song, people just won't pay the 99 cents for it, that's a good arbiter. I don't know, we're in the middle of it now.
Sure. We'll see where it goes. We're going to start taking questions from the audience after this part, so that we'll have you come up to the microphone. You can start thinking about the questions and what you might want to ask. But as a producer, how do you look at an artist, whether it's Poison or Mick and Keith, and tell them, don't do that? You know, don't do that. How tough is that to do?
Well, tact is a good thing to employ there. You can't say to somebody this thing that you did that came from your heart stinks. You know, I mean, you really can't do that. I've had problems with it. As diplomatic as you want to be, sometimes people don't want to hear. There's a period of time Keith Richards wouldn't speak to me for about a year and a half.
Really?
Because I advised him to take a song off an album, and I said, you know, you don't need it. It's a song called Thief in the Night. It's the last to hit. It's like the last track on Bridges to Babylon. And I thought it took away from the song that came before it, which was also one of his songs. That was, I thought, the best thing, you know, that he'd ever done. But he didn't want to hear that. You just have to be careful. You know, I was lucky that When Was Not Was, when we had our biggest hits, Walk the Dinosaur and Spy in the House of Love, the record company made us get a producer for that. And that was really hard. I was a terrible subject, you know. I was a terrible client to have. I was a hostile takeover of the band, basically. I'm grateful to the guy. The guy's name is Paulo Duffy, and he did deliver hit records for us, and it changed all of our lives. But I just hate it, you know, sitting there, you know, you play something and you know when you've done something and it's good and it rings true. And then to have silence coming from the booth, it's just, oh, come on, man, you know. Or then maybe a guy leaning on a, he'll wait 10 seconds and lean on the button and say, can you do another one? You know that he didn't hear it. If you did something good and you know it, you know that your producer didn't hear it. The guy you're paying all this money to, and it's just you. There's no, you can't feel any more alone than that.
Yeah.
So I'll
learn. Make sure to talk after every take.
I do. I really do. I try to, even if it's bullshit, just say something. You know, don't leave them hanging. At least let them know they're not like in a deprivation tank out there. You know?
Okay, we do have the microphone out here. If you have some questions, while we're waiting, tell the great story about dressing Louis Resto for the Oscars.
Oh, is Louis here? he was staying at my house. Do you know who Louis Resto? We played on the first Was Not Was album, when he was like 16 years old, he's just this child prodigy kind of guy who, he was the first synthesizer player I ever met who wasn't a piano player who bought a synthesizer because it was the latest thing. That was his instrument, you know, and he used to keep the top open, you know, unscrewed so he could get in there, and he'd fiddle with the electronics as part of the thing. And, you know, it was like an essential part of all our records. Stayed in Detroit when we moved out there and started working with Eminem and co-wrote a lot of those songs and was nominated for and ultimately won an Oscar for Lose Yourself. So he went out to go to the Oscar ceremony, stayed in my house, and he was leaving for the thing in this red tuxedo. That was just... I said, come on, man, you're representing the Eminem organization. And so I dressed him. Actually, I gave him every totemic piece of clothing I had, everything that I'd ever used for good luck. I had there's a shirt that I was in a clothing store, and I saw Ringo Starr in there, and I produced him, so I knew him. And I think it was the year that Was No Was was up for a Grammy for Papa Was a Rolling Stone, and he said, wear this shirt to the Grammys. And it's an awful shirt, man. You know, it's like a short sleeve sports shirt with a bunch of stars, like Ringo Starr. But this guy's got some mojo going. If anyone's got mojo going, it's Ringo Starr, right? You know, and I didn't wear the shirt. And he called me the next day, and he said, "You didn't wear the shirt, man. You lost." And a couple of years later, it dawned on me, you know, that it was such an arrogant act on my part that I would ignore the sign, you know, and think, no, it's all me, right? You know, I can do this. So I used to hang the shirt in the closet just to remind myself, you know, not to be such a jerk all the time, right? And so it seemed time to break it out. So I put Louis in that shirt. I gave him a guitar pick, a Keith Richards that still had some mysterious powder in the indentation.
Could have been his dad.
And a poker chip from Monte Carlo that Waylon Jennings gave me, and a jacket that Richie Sambora gave me, and this Grant Hill shirt, which I've worn for good luck to every gig we've played since 19... whenever that, you know, when did he play for the Pistons? Like, it was the early 90s. Right?
Yeah.
And he won. And he got up there. Eminem didn't show up, right? So it's just Louis, right? And he comes up there, and Barbra Streisand looked at him and said, "You're Louis Resto." And there's a picture that from the wire services of just her, the most disdainful look. And he made, like, the worst dressed list in every People magazine. Uh-huh. But he won.
But he won. So he had the Oscar, which is the best piece, which is the best accessory you could have. If I'm Clive Davis, God forbid, or Simon Fuller, and I want to hand you one of these American Idols, you know, who we only know from having sung a bunch of other people's songs, so you don't necessarily have a sense of who somebody like that is. I'm going to dump an 18-year-old young woman in your lap or for only creative purpose.
Well,
I'm not even creative purpose. Anyway, I'll get away from that. Or, you know, a 29-year-old white-haired guy. What do you do?
Well, Nancy Reagan said it best. Just say no. No, you try. I would try to do something. I thought it would be cool to take that kid Sanjaya and do something legitimate with him, but I don't know.
With him or his hair?
That's beyond hope. We toured with Milli Vanilli.
Yes, we did.
And we got to know these guys, and they were all right guys. I didn't blame them for any of it. They were just guys who wanted to be rock and roll stars, and people said, do this, and they did it, and snort this, and they snorted that, and then they said, now we're taking it away from you for doing what we said. And I thought it was really unfair. And so I called them after they were disgraced, and I said, you know, if you would just write a song about what you've been through, the truth, you know, it would be a great story. You know, you'd go from being pariahs to being pretty legitimate artists. Just tell what happened to you. And they said, okay, we'll work on that. And they called me 2 days later, and they had something called, you know, Dance, Go Dance. They missed the point. You know? But, so I'm loath to try to you know, like, there's something a little arrogant about this whole thing of this Henry Higgins thing, like, that you're going to take Sanjaya and, yeah, maybe some, maybe Sanjaya, he made that little girl cry, you know, maybe he's the greatest.
Was it true, you guys, on that tour that you used to steal Millie Vanilli's dad, or was that just an urban legend?
It's still there. What?
They used to steal the dad, the backing tape they would use to sing to, or was that an urban? You're past the statute of limitations for that tour.
Yeah, no, we didn't steal it, but we dug it when it messed up. There's maybe the greatest lesson I ever learned on my personal music journey. Okay, and. We were on this Club MTV tour. It was not was. We were the only band who played anything live on this tour. And Paula Abdul, Tone Loke, who didn't even bother like to make tapes. He just talked over his records. It's like a sock hop in front of 16,000 people. And Millie Vanilli. And one time, Downtown Julie Brown came out and introduced them, and they came, you know, bouncing out. And the tape was broken. And part of it worked. There were some guys playing live, but they just were bouncing and bouncing and bouncing, and nothing was coming out. It was kind of like the Ashley Simpson thing. Uh-huh. And they were disgusted, and they were pretty high, too. And they ran to the side and, like, punched the monitor guy out, and they went back in their bus, and they were trashing the bus. And, like, minutes went by. And it was really awkward. It was at the Riverfront Fest or some of that in Milwaukee? Is that where that is? Yeah. And it's a real steep incline. So you got 20,000 people in a natural amphitheater, but it's a steep one. So you can see everybody. So it's like being in a fishbowl. It was really intense to mess up in that situation. So Downtown Julie Brown went back to the bus and got these guys and, you know, talked them down. 5 minutes went by. They came back out. They fixed the tape. They started over. And nobody cared. That was the thing. That was the lesson, was that people had come out to see the videos come to life. That's why you went to the Club MTV tour. You didn't go to hear a nine-piece soul band. You know, that big deal, you could play all your own instruments. What they came there to do was to be entertained by the videos coming to life, and Millie Vanilli provided that. And the fact that they weren't playing was of no consequence. And so I was humbled in the face of that. I thought, I'm the wrong guy here. You know, I mean, what arrogance to go in there thinking, well, we play live. Well, you people don't like what you're doing.
Is there at this point, I mean, you've worked with so many people that the wish list has to have continued to shrunk, but who would you like to work with now?
I don't know, that's a good one. You know, some people you'd like to, I like their records. Like Bruce Springsteen, yeah. I really like his records, but I don't know what to do any different with him than like what Brendan O'Brien's been doing with him, or I'm sure Rick Rubin, who's producing a Metallica record now, which I would love to do something like that. I'm sure he'll do. I'm sure he's just tuned into that better. So in some cases, you have to say, well, it would be fun, but it would probably be better for everybody if I just buy the record in the store when it comes out. I don't know. I like the band we were talking about. Old Crow Medicine Show. I'd like to do something. There's certain things that I have some insight into how to make the record, and certain things I don't. But one thing I do know is you shouldn't try to look at what's happening in the market and imitate it. That's a surefire way of failing. So a lot of stuff that's out there I don't get, and I'm not embarrassed by that, but.
Was there a point in your career where they did come to you for that, where they said, can you do what they're doing here with this artist?
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole period in the 80s where nothing was happening. You know, I mean, every record stiff like that. You know, I mean, I was just, but you know this. If there's a style of music that you're identifying with your own personal life and your lifestyle and, you know, like the 60s for me, you know, like hippie music or Dylan music, the stuff that came out in that period of time. You knew the difference between Bob Dylan and Trini Lopez. Even if my grandmother didn't, they were both guys with guitars, you know, who were on the charts. But there was some fundamental difference there. And if you miss it by 3 degrees, because you don't really understand the essence of it, you might as well miss it by, you know, you miss it by miles. You get it wrong, and the people know that. So for years, I, you know, when we did Nick of Time with Bonnie Raitt, That was like a vacation from trying to make these kind of pop dance records. You know, like that came along in a period of time when, you know, it was all, it was, you know, Flock of Seagulls and Thompson Twins and that kind of music, and which was fine. I just didn't know how to, I had no affinity for that. And so we made Nick of Time. My manager said, well, just get it over with us so we can get back to doing something real like Elisa Fiorello. God bless her. I don't mean to knock Elisa Fiorello, but who, you say, right? Which is the point, yeah. And so that was a Nick of Time was a recreational album because I so was into Bonnie Raitt, you know, from I bought her first record. There was no mystery. You didn't have to figure out anything. In fact, it was kind of a relief not to chase the radio. We had $150,000 because her manager said it. Her royalty was $1 a record. He said, I'll pay you back if we don't sell the $150,000. You know, if we don't make it back out of our royalties, I'll pay you back the difference. I'm sure we'll sell $150,000. So that's all we were geared for. We weren't even trying to be on the radio.
Wow.
And that was probably the lesson. That sold 7 million records. So when you do something for the right... Yeah.
Now, it's you know, I don't know if it's that one, but in all this stuff you've done, do you have a favorite either album or song? Talk amongst yourselves.
Yeah, no, I have favorites. I love this Willie Nelson record I did called Across the Borderline.
Oh, yeah.
That's one that I'll actually play to listen to. A lot of them are good experiences, and Nick of Time, that's actually really, you know, I was interviewed to promote this appearance today on by Warren Pierce.
Warren Pierce.
Do people? and he played that song to lead into the interview. And I hadn't heard it in a really long time.
Did anyone hear it on the radio today? Since people didn't hear it, could we hear it?
Yeah, I could play. All right. It's actually a great song to do at this moment because I think it ties up a lot of the things we're talking about. It's a hopeful song, you know, that it certainly applies to all these business things, the auto business as well, as you pointed out, the city of Detroit as well, but that when you can't figure out how problems are going to be worked out, something happens. It might be inadvertent, like Edison signing the great music, or BMI signing all the blues artists and everything, but something always happens to make things work out in the end. And yeah,
that's good.
Okay. I'm blank checking. A friend of mine, she cries all night, then calls me on the phone. She sees babies everywhere she goes, and she wants one of her own. She's waited long enough, she says, but still she can't decide. Though pretty soon she'll have to choose, and that tears her up inside. She's scared. Scared she'll run out of time. I see my folks getting old, and I see their bodies change. I know they see the same thing in me, and it makes us both feel strange. No matter how much you tell yourself that this is what we all go through, them lines get kind of hard to take when they're staring back at you. And when you're scared, scared to run out of time. When did the choices get so hard with so much more at stake? Life gets kind of precious when there's less of it to waste. And you're scared, scared you'll run out of time.
And just when I thought I had enough and all my tears were shed, all painful words were spoken and promises unsaid, you came along and showed me how to leave it all behind. You opened up my heart, and then much to my surprise, I found love in the nick of time. Love in the nick of time.
That's a good song.
Great song. Okay. Thank you, Don Was. Thank you very much for coming in for this. Heaven, thank you all for coming out today. Again, our special guest, the Airborne Harmonica player, David Was. Make sure you go check out the exhibit. Come early, come often, and we'll see you again.